WSB's Money Matters with Wes Moss. Certified financial planner and chief investment strategist from Atlanta's Capital Investment Advisors. Wes talks to you about investing and saving for the future. Brought to you every Sunday by RBM of Atlanta Mercedes-Benz, Sandy Springs.
Good morning. Welcome to Money Matters here on a Sunday morning, like we're here every Sunday morning, 9 to 11. I'm your host, Wes Moss, here to take your calls and questions and try to figure out a path to get to retirement so that you can navigate the crazy world that we all live in. And one thing that makes the environment that we're living in today, of course, has to do with the political environment. And I have a guest today. Rarely do I do interviews. And when I do interviews, I want them to be something extremely unique and something that you haven't heard before. And that's part of what we're going to do today. We're talking to an expert in policy and an expert who, I don't know if he'd call himself a Washington insider, but as far as I'm concerned, he is. And someone that really understands what's happening in Washington, D.C., and works at a research firm that I hold in very high regard that also tries to kind of connect the dots between policy in Washington and what happens in Wall Street. And with me today, Dan Clifton, a partner at Strategus Research Partners out of New York and D.C. and Geneva. And Dan Clifton, are you there with me today?
I am. Thanks for having me on, Wes. It's great to be here.
Very good to be with you on the air. I know we've certainly talked a lot over the years about similar topics, and I can tell you that our listeners probably remember back when we were facing the fiscal cliff.
Yeah.
And we were facing default on our debt.
That's right.
Dan Clifton is the resource that really helped me guide me through the probabilities and the outcomes of that particular scary time. Mm-hmm. And I remember getting a lot of feedback about that guidance, and I gave back at least most of the credit to Dan Clifton. And because it was hard to figure out what was actually going to happen, and you nailed it. So you said that there's no way they're going to default. We didn't, and we kind of lived to fight another day, and the market was higher because of that. So so that's the kind of insight that Dan has. Today, because we have an election coming up this fall, we still think it's probably, of course, Hillary and Trump. But there's an interesting piece that Dan wrote this week that says the S&P 500 has correctly predicted 19 of the past 22 presidential elections, going back all the way back to 1928. So, Dan, why don't you take it from there and just tell us why this happens and how much efficacy you see in this pattern?
Sure. Yeah. So, Wes, thank you for having me on. And it's interesting that you bring up 2011, the debt ceiling crisis, 2012, and the fiscal cliff. They were both big events for financial markets. And I think one of the great lessons from those two events is that the process is just as important as the outcome for investors. Although we didn't default on our debt and although we didn't go off the fiscal cliff, there was a lot of uncertainty that got associated with those events, and the market kind of had to wait out the final outcome. And I think we're in a similar situation with the 2016 election. This is an open election year. Open election years generally tend to have a little bit more struggle in the equity market, largely because the candidates running for office we don't know as well.
Right. When you say open, Dan, you're really referring to we don't have an incumbent running again.
That's correct. I'm sorry for not being clear on that. That's right. You know, there is no incumbent president running for re-election. It's about a 95% probability that this will be Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton, according to the betting market odds. And as a result, we look for different indicators that can kind of guide us through this election. One of those is the broad S&P 500, just the broad stock market in general. And as you mentioned, we've had 22 elections since 1928. And of those 22 elections, the S&P 500 has correctly predicted the winner in 19 of those 22 winners, 19 of those 22 elections, and has predicted every election correctly right since 1984. And the way that we do this is we went back and we looked at stock market returns and what the election outcome could be, and most of the analysis that we tried failed. We tried 1 month before the election. We tried 6 months before the election. We tried 9 months, 1 year. You get the gist of that. But at the end of the day, 3 months before the election, so really from the beginning of August to the beginning of November, if stocks are higher, the party that already occupies the White House wins re-election or another term. And if the stock market is negative in that 3 month period, then the opposition Party wins. If you think about 2008, we had a very big declining stock market. The Republicans controlled the White House, and eventually Barack Obama won that election. You know, you look at 2000, we had a falling stock market during that time. Al Gore was running to replace Bill Clinton, and he lost to George W. Bush. But if you look at the years in between that, 2004, 2012, stocks were up in that three-month period, and George Bush won re-election, Barack Obama won re-election. So it's been a pretty good indicator, and I think it works, Wes, because the stock market is telling you where the economy is.
So now, to put this into context, we've got 19 out of 22, so we're talking around 85% of the time.
That's right. Yep.
If the market's up, the incumbents win. If the market is down, that's signaling that obviously the economy isn't doing well. There's not a great economic outlook, and then we blame the incumbent party. So let's say you're a Donald Trump fan, again, politics aside, I know you don't take sides on this.
Yes, we
even
don't.
Though most I know where most of our listeners stand on this. Does the Republican base then root for a bad stock market the 3 months before the election? I guess that's the question. Can you stomach a 3 month downtrend just to have your party win 85% of the time, Dan?
I'm not sure they root for it, but I think some people believe that the economy is weaker than the official statistics make it out to be, and think that the economy should be weaker, or that the economy should be reported on that, and that's probably why they think, you know, maybe Donald Trump can come in and change that. It's interesting. This morning we were looking at the overnight betting odd probabilities of Hillary Clinton, and there's about a 95% correlation between Hillary Clinton's probability and the S&P 500.
So explain that a little further for our listeners, Dan.
So we like polls. We look at polls, but we also, as investors, like to know where the consensus is. So we look at these websites like Betfair or electionbettingodds.com, where people actually put money on betting on political events. So they're putting their money where their thoughts are, and that tells us in real time where the consensus is. And right now, the consensus gives about a 68% probability that Hillary Clinton will beat Donald Trump in the general election. We actually think Trump's odds are higher than where the betting odds are right now, but we matched up Hillary's betting odds since the beginning of this year with the S&P 500, and the two almost move in perfect coordination with each other. So as the stock market is going down, Hillary's probability of re-election goes down, and vice versa. And based on that number, stocks would have to fall about 8.5% to get Trump to that 51% where he would need to win in terms of probability. So in terms of the magnitude of the sell-off, it's actually less than 10%. And we were just trying to kind of gauge how big of a market decline you would need for Trump to be able to kind of pull ahead in the election.
Well, and you've written several pieces about a path to either party winning, and yep. That's really a conversation for another day, because I want to get into some of the thoughts about what Washington really means, what the White House means, what Congress means, and really how do you connect the dots back to corporate America, to corporate profits. And that is this what I consider a really fascinating linkage. I think for so many years, and this continues to be the case, investors kind of blanketly think, well, a Republican in the White House is either good or bad, or Democrat in the White House is either good or bad, or they might relate that back to the Congress that's good or bad. When in reality, I think we all know, if we think about it for more than a minute, that one person at the very top really can't completely stem or change this gigantic gravitational pull or economic tide that is the United States economy. It just can't happen in such singular fashion. But there's no denying that there is certainly tremendous influence when it comes to corporate America on particular policy and what's happening in law related back to companies. So I think that and some of the work that you've done over the last many years now, this is not a new study for you guys. It's just how do you think through, and what's your approach to trying to figure out really what does well? Is it sectors? Is it companies? How do you figure out what benefits or gets hurt from a particular group. And first, we'll start, is it White House, is it Congress, is it Senate, or is it kind of all the above, Dan?
Yeah, it's all the above. So, you know, people say to me, who's better for the economy, who's better for the stock market? Markets aren't really partisan, but on a sector basis, it could have a very wide impact. So if you just take, for example, the coal industry, we've just seen a number of bankruptcies. President Obama basically campaigned, said he was going to make coal bankrupt. He's basically achieved that. So if you're a coal company,
he's done
it. Didn't want to see the Democrats go in. And conversely, if you're a hospital, you've done really well because of the Affordable Care Act and all the 10 million people that now have health insurance. So on a sector basis, we can look at the election. We can figure out which sectors are going to be winners and losers, depending on who wins the election. And then we break it up even more narrowly than that, Wes, because we're trying to really understand which companies are involved in the effort to get these bills passed. You know, Congress doesn't wake up one day and just say, hey, I want to do X, Y, and Z on this bill. I'm sure there's some of that, but mostly it's being driven by interest. And it doesn't have to be looked at in a bad way, but defense companies want more defense spending, and drug companies don't want any restrictions on their pricing, and infrastructure companies want more highway spending. And so what we do is we figure out which of those companies are really pushing for those proposals. And then we start to create baskets for our clients so that if Congress is going to enact these policies, then you could start figuring out who the winners and losers are of that. Some people would be offended by it, but it is a way of life. And if you look right at what's been going on in this market right now, we did a massive budget deal in December. We started to increase spending. We provided tax incentives. Wes, we did this because the economy is slowing and the Congress wants to get reelected. And so many of the companies that are levered to that new stimulus have really been outperforming.
And we're starting to see that in the markets. And so, Dan, hold that thought for me. We're going to get back to continue to talk about this. And my number here, you might have another number, but again, from what I see, companies are spending anywhere from $2.5 to $3 billion a year on, whether it's lobbying or just public interest and public campaigns. It's a very real number. And again, these are public numbers, so none of this is really, none of this is a secret, but obviously there's some influence when it comes to particular industries, which we'll continue to talk about. On the line with me, again, you've just tuned into Money Matters. Fascinating interview today with Dan Clifton, a partner at Strategus Research Partners. His specialty is policy and then how that impacts markets and companies. And that's exactly what we're going to dive into even further as soon as we get back from a quick break. So news, weather, traffic, then more Money Matters right here. News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB. Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters. Let's call this a policy or political Sunday and how that relates back to markets. Sectors, individual companies to some extent. On the line with me, Dan Clifton, a partner at Strategus Research Partners, and his specialty has to do with understanding what companies are doing in Washington. It's a big part of his job and what Congress is doing. He's helped me tremendously over many years. And Dan, what are a couple, we have a short segment here.
Yep.
What are some companies, I saw that Google or Alphabet lobbies,
yep.
And
yep.
What are these companies, give me some examples. I mean, why is Google what are they lobbying for?
Yeah. So Google is probably one of the largest spenders. They call themselves Alphabet now, but they're one of the largest spenders of lobbying here in Washington. I just read an article the other day that there's an Alphabet staffer, Google staffer at the White House at least once a week. And you know, there's a lot of different initiatives that they're lobbying on because they have a lot of different parts to their business. Is it driverless cars? Is it search and data protection and privacy? You're seeing a big issue with Apple and the FBI. So some of it is defense. Some of it is offense. They want to be able to create a regulatory structure that benefits their company. They want to be able to take advantage of tax benefits that benefit their company. But Google has become such a big company, and they're lobbying on so many different issues at this point that many of the issues that they're lobbying on are probably not the greatest return on investment for their incremental assets. And I would say the same thing similar to other large companies like maybe GE, AT&T. So just spending a lot of money isn't really a good metric for these companies. The question is, what kind of return on investment are they getting on that lobbying? And I think that's probably a better metric and one that people are trying to get a better handle on.
We'll continue the conversation. On the line here, Dan Clifton, we're talking about policy and how it relates back to the stock market, and of course how that relates back to you as an individual investor trying to get to retirement or through retirement. You're tuned in to Money Matters. Stay tuned for more interview with Dan Clifton straight ahead.
Hi, this is Scott Slade from Atlanta's Morning News and WSB. Our 24-hour news center delivers updates 4 times an hour all weekend. Depend on it. We'll be back Monday morning, 4:30 tonight, for breaking news and traffic and weather every 6 minutes. News 95.5 at AM 750 WSB. Now, here's more great money and investment advice from certified financial planner Wes Moss.
Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters here on WSB Radio. The fascinating conversation. We're in the middle of election season, and we just had an interesting statistic through my guest who's on the line with me, Dan Clifton, that the S&P 500 has correctly predicted in the last 22 election cycles, 19 of the last 22, you do the math, it's 86% of the time, going all the way back to 1928, it's has predicted the results of the election. So Dan, here we are with the S&P 500 this year. That's it can never seem to get much above 2 or 3 or 4% higher. We go back out down into negative territory. Is the market just kind of telling us something that it really doesn't know yet? We're still too far away.
Yeah, and I would say while the betting odds have placed large bets on Hillary Clinton, or they're saying that Hillary Clinton is a wide probability. I believe it's too early. You'll really get to know about this race right around July 21st and July 28th. Those are going to be when the Republicans and Democrats hold their convention. You'll get another key data point on September 26th. That will be the first debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, and it will be a global phenomenon. Over 100 million people turning on their TV to watch Trump and Clinton duke it out. It's better than Tyson Holyfield. It's better than the WWE. And it's better than any reality TV show we have. And I think once you get...
Except for maybe The Apprentice, though, right? Because that's part of what launched Donald Trump's real career, right, Dan?
That's exactly right. I mean, he's learned from TV how to make this TV. I mean, he's talking about speaking every night at his convention. I've never seen that happen in my life. But people are going to turn in and watch him on that show.
So we think the rating... You did this fascinating chart not long ago where you literally looked at the ratings of the debates relative to the most popular TV shows in America.
Yep.
And these are real numbers then. So this literally, I don't know what's popular in America right now because I only listen to financial radio, but isn't like something, what's popular? The Voice? So the debates will beat out The Voice?
Show. The Bachelor, pick your reality TV show, American Idol, which is in its final season, and there are 18.5 million people that are watching the Republican debate, and that's more than any of those TV shows. And that tells you something. It tells you, one, there's an entertainment factor to our politics, but more importantly, people are worried about job creation, they're worried about the economy, they're culturally worried about the country, and I think that's creating this wide interest in this election, and I think that could really help produce some outcomes post-election that could lead to more fiscal policy stimulus and lead to more types of policies that are going to get U.S. economic growth going. And that would be good for the country if we get there.
So as we try to connect the dots then from Washington back to Wall Street, and it really is this constant mechanism that goes in between both of these forces. And you go through the GOP as the primaries have gone on. Obviously, Trump has continued to be attacked about spending money in Washington and trying to influence policy, whether it's a defense or offense, like you're saying.
Yep.
And Trump's position on this is that, hey, look, I'm a business guy, and I try to get along with everyone. And I can legally do my best to try to influence policy. So what are now some examples? And again, how do you approach finding sectors that are going to benefit from either, and I want you to explain this, what you call either offense or defense when it comes to Washington, and maybe give some examples.
So let me give you a few examples. Number one, Donald Trump is talking about building a wall around the Mexican border. We can have a debate about whether he's going to build a wall or not, but in the short run, we're not going to have a wall up right away. And so what we're talking about is that drones are a very quick way to be able to monitor the border. And so we're looking at infrastructure companies that are going to help defend the border. We're looking at communications companies that are going to help defend the border. And we're looking at drone companies that could really help patrol that wide border if until a resolution of Donald Trump's priorities get put into effect. He's very worried about what's going on around the rest of the world and the U.S. being challenged geopolitically. No matter who gets elected, defense spending is going higher. We just think it's going to go higher under President Trump if he gets there. On the other side, you know, Donald Trump is talking about a lot of different proposals, some of which could be negative for industries. One, he's talking about doing price negotiation of prescription drugs, which is essentially a de facto price control on them. Now, you know, Congress matters. Will Republican Congress go along with that? We could have that debate, but you could tell that there's probably some people in the pharmaceutical industry who are a bit worried to hear a Republican talking about price control. So what we do is we go in, we say, what is he proposing? How does this impact a sector, and which companies are then lobbying on that to prevent that from happening, so that we understand where the risks and opportunities are for our clients? And if I could just give you one example here, Wes.
Please.
During the Affordable Care Act debate in 2009, the managed care companies, which are widely owned, they're probably in every 401k in America, those stocks were trading as if they were going to go out of business based on the Affordable Care Act.
You're talking about the United Healthcares of the world, the Aetnas of the world.
That's exactly right. Sorry for not being clear on that. And they were trading at 6x earnings, right? And so what we're just trying to do is manage that risk for our clients so that they don't get completely blown out of water on something defensive. But we're also looking for those opportunities on something that could be an offensive lobbying strategy.
So here we talk about, and this is always fascinating to me, is that what the allocation from Congress is when it comes to defense, national defense. And you,
yep.
I know that you've done studies on this, and we look at charts that say, but you know, back in the 60s, we were spending 10% of GDP on national defense. And that number has effectively came down from the 60s all the way to 2002, got a little bit of a bump up to 2008-09, and then has trailed off. But where do you see that gigantic spend when it comes to national defense? Is it going higher? Is it going lower? And who could benefit from that?
So we think it's going higher. Usually when we get to about 3% of gross domestic product, that's a blow in defense spending, and usually we go higher. We've been trending somewhere between 3 and 4% of GDP since, I don't know, maybe 1995. And I think that we're going back higher in that respect. Wes, one thing is that we usually have these six-year budget cycles where we go up for 6 years, we go down for 6 years. We just finished out our six-year budget cycle on the way down. Now we'll be going on our way back up. And so the companies that we like to see in there are companies such as Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, which is a pure play on Middle East violence because they make the missiles that the Middle East customers, which are countries, really like. So one, you're going to get an increase in defense spending. Two, you're seeing more foreign sales. So these companies are selling more equipment now to foreign countries because you have to increase defense spending globally. You can't just rely on the U.S. anymore. And third, we went through a series of budget cuts a few years ago. I really believe that that's forced the defense industry to start to become more efficient. They had to kind of cut their budgets, get the fat out. And now that the defense budget's going to increase, that top-line revenue growth is really going to help them on the other side. So defense is a really good place to be, particularly when you come to lobbying, and because we're at the end of that six-year budget cycle.
And then to some extent, you're going beyond. When you say defense, it might be something that it may not just be Lockheed Martins or the Raytheons in the world. When you're talking about drones, a company that makes drones, I mean, this is a whole other iteration of vigilance, if you will, or to some extent defense.
Yeah, we like L3 Communications because they're very specific in what they're working on. Harris Communications is another one that we've seen in the past because they have the consulting contract for the secured room where the president does all of his work. So there's all these different iterations. One of them that we previously were looking at was a company called FLIR, FLIR. They make the goggles, the night goggles that you need for our troops when they're out serving our country and need to see at night. So there are different iterations of that defense, different companies providing different needs, and based on where those budget allocations are, we can figure out which companies are best positioned for that.
So Dan, we've talked a little bit about some of these some of these main areas: healthcare, defense. And some of these communication companies that are around defense, is there any other major industry or sub-industry that you see that perking up to some extent or really trying to be aggressive in Washington so that they're in line with current law?
Yeah, so we're now starting to look at not only drones, as you mentioned before, but also semiconductors. And the reason is that the semiconductor industry are really a pure play on driverless cars and different types of these. You know, we read about them in magazines or see the Google car driving around.
Yeah, so sensors. So really, it's sensors and backup cameras, things like that, which also tie back to law.
That's correct. This is all unknown frontier, Wes, right? Unknown. So the rules have to be written because it's not even, we got to change the rules. We need new rules for this. And so what we see are the semiconductors, because they're very big into the sensor industry. This could be a $1 trillion opportunity for investors. We actually see companies like Amazon coming in and lobbying. We haven't seen big spending from Amazon in almost a decade since they were worried about sales tax on the internet. But now they're worried
about
drones because they want the drones to deliver the packages. They want driverless cars to drive the packages there. And it's almost starting to look like a little bit of a sci-fi movie, but you could have an Amazon truck pull up to your house and have a drone deliver the package right to your front door. We need new rules for this, and they're on the forefront of doing these types of rules. So really understanding these technological innovations, which companies are behind it, and how they're trying to structure the rules, I think is critical for investors moving forward.
It is. It's such a fascinating topic, and we'll be talking more about it over the next year because it's a big part of what moves the markets. And Dan, thank you so much for today. We've relied on your work for so many years, and we appreciate it. If you're out there listening and you're saying, Wes, wow, this is fascinating. We're happy to continue the conversation and talk this through because there's a lot to this conversation when it comes to specifically you being an investor. So obviously on Money Matters, I don't tout certain stocks. We don't recommend any particular companies. But as a strategy, this is something that is certainly comes into my decision process. So if you have questions about it or how it might relate back to your own portfolio, of course, email me. If you go to my website, it's just wesmoss.com, WESMOSS.com. There's a contact button on the upper right-hand side or one right in the middle of the homepage. Those emails come straight to me and the Money Matters team. Of course, we're happy to sit down and talk this through, or any other questions, of course, that you face when it comes to your finances, of course, and how it might relate back to being an investor. I've just relaunched wesmoss.com, so it's got a new look and feel to it. The jury's still out, so certainly send me an email about this. And we've had a couple of email communication problems, so if you haven't heard back from me in a couple of days, it might be that we're trying to work out some new technology. So again, shoot me a quick email either way. And just either you want to tell me about, you think my website, new website's awful. I'm happy for that feedback too. So again, my website, just wesmoss.com, WESMOSS.com. Contact button on the upper right-hand side or in the middle. Those emails come straight to me and Ryan Ely, producer of Money Matters and the Money Matters team. Stay tuned to Money Matters here, News 95.5 and AM 750 WSB. Good morning. Welcome back to Money Matters. We found out a lot today about politics, didn't we? We really, one of the most fascinating topics that we haven't covered enough, and now we will, particularly as we go into election season. The S&P 500 has correctly predicted 19 of the past 22 presidential elections, going all the way back to 1928. So we've got to wait a couple of months. It's about a three-month window that we can do this. So come this fall, late summer, the market might very well tell us who ends up winning this race, whether it's Hillary, whether it's Donald. Of course, there'll be questions about this as we continue to talk about how policy and companies influence Washington and what that lobbying really means and what lobbying spending can do to a whole sector or a particular company. Something that me and the Money Matters team, along with our research partners, Strategus Research Partners out of New York and Geneva and all over the globe, We spend a lot of time trying to figure that out. So if you have questions about this more specifically, head to my website, wesmoss.com, WESMOSS.com. Contact button, right side, upper right-hand side. Those emails come straight to me, and we'd be happy to continue the conversation and how it relates back to you and your overall planning. You're listening to Money Matters. Me and the Money Matters team, wesmoss.com, WESMOSS.com. Straight ahead, more of your calls and questions right here on WSB.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, my lover stands on golden sand.
Don't you miss the days when you could walk?